Thank you, Ron. Thank you very much. Thank you for inviting me. It's wonderful to be here. I feel like that what it says above the entrance door, you know, if you don't know geometry, don't come in, should have kept me out, but nobody was checking. So, and in fact, when I got in at the border, a fellow asked me what I did for a living, and I said biophysics, and he heard physics. And he said, oh, physics, it's fantastic. Black holes, he said, black holes and dark matter. So I said, not really, but yeah. So as a reminder, I am not a physicist at all. And in fact, I discovered I was a quantum biologist one day when Greg Engel, the photosynthesis guy, called me up and told me so. He called me up and he said, DARPA wants to fund quantum biology. And I said, great, how does that help me? And he says, you're doing quantum biology. Really? That's wonderful. So however, I do have physicist friends. And for those of you who are interested in this, the subject that I'm going to deal with today, in greater depth, complete with equations, the definition of biophysics is any biological paper that contains at least one equation. Okay. There's no need for any additional specifications. So this one contains lots of equations, most of which I don't understand. But my two co-authors, Andrew Horsfield at Imperial and Albert Haase in Trento in Italy, do understand what's going on. And this has just come out in Advances in Physics. Is it 10 or is it X? I have the same trouble with iPhones. Advances in Physics X, I believe. So I'm vaguely aware of the fact that in physics there are tremendous controversies and intense hatreds and books written. And I assume you people must think that biologists are awfully nice, sort of herbivores. And but I can assure you this is not the case. And to give you an example of the sort of anger, you know, sound and fury that our work has aroused, this is one. There's a paper in PNAS 2 or 3 years ago titled Implausibility of the Vibrational Theory of Olfaction, which is what I'm going to be talking about, with a huge amount of data. It actually doesn't amount to a hill of beans, but it caused us to immediately reply with, you know, and this is the sort of stuff that goes on. So I'm just reassuring you, it's not just string theory where people are mad at each other. In fact, Leslie Vosshall, who just got into the National Academy, said this to the BBC, and I rather like this. I take it as very much as a compliment, because we are herbivores, but I'd rather be a beast of legend than a beast of burden, as I explained to the journalist. And she got into the next issue of PNAS a quite extraordinary screed decreeing a theory officially dead, which is a most unusual thing, fortunately, in all the sciences. This is on the basis of one paper. That's it. It's over. It's not over, as you will see. So a little bit of anatomy is handy. The olfactory epithelium is the only part of your brain, literally, that's dangling in the breeze, okay, that's exposed to the outside air. Usually there is a bone separating the olfactory bulb, which is the big yellow part, with the olfactory neurons that are actually projecting in your nose cavity. But sometimes the bone is absent. So don't ever do what I did, and don't ever put anything, you know, optic fiber or anything up there, because you're not sure that there is bone. And the neurons project, and they have cilia. And the cilia bear receptors, and those receptors are the proteins which detect odorants. So smelly molecules are called odorants. And here I have the range of odorants, the range of size of odorants, to give you a feel for how big they are. And so dimethyl sulfide is the smell, it's the sulfur smell of lychees. You guys, okay, lychees are the smell of rose, chiefly, but also a little bit of dimethyl sulfide, which is kind of like durian. If you don't put the dimethyl sulfide, you get a rose smell, not a lychee smell. And this is a musk, which was discovered by somebody who was making TNT, trinitrotoluene explosives. And one day he made this guy, and it was a lousy explosive, but it smelled great. And so he built an entire business on this, independent of explosions. And that covers about the range of size of odorants. Anything bigger than this has no smell. Not because it doesn't evaporate, but because it doesn't fit into the receptors. So the standard theory, the standard model, I think I should use that phrase, be appropriate, is the following. There's a very large number of receptors, an unusually large number of receptors, in the sense that in each of our noses is about 400 different types of receptors, and which is unusual because, for example, for other things in the brain like neurotransmitters, there might be like 10 different dopamine receptors or 10 different serotonin receptors, but we're talking 400 for humans, 1,000 for mice, so it's a very large number. And the idea is that, the idea originally was that, well, basically there's a combinatorial code, so that here this would be the sort of binary word corresponding to those receptors. Here you have a matrix of receptors and odorants, and each receptor responds to a different set of odorants with different intensities. So you can imagine there's a sort of, you can imagine that, you know, the smell of the odorant is determined by the, so to speak, binary word which is turned on in your nose. Now, since there are 400, that is a very large number. And therefore, you can, once you've assumed that this is how it works, you can do what people often do in faced with difficult problems, which is to retreat and declare victory. Okay? You have, in a sense, explained away. There's nothing you can't explain after the fact, but you can't predict anything. Now, the reason you can't predict anything much, so let me try and explain. There's the industry, so to speak, of odorants, of smell is separated into two factions that don't talk to each other. There's the fragrance chemists who make molecules for big perfumery companies, and they can't predict smell, and you know that. How do you know that? Because you know that because there's hundreds of chemists, okay? When you get to a company that has a building 10 stories tall with 35 synthetic labs, you know they don't predict, because if they could, they'd only be like two, okay? And when they discovered the receptors in 91, Linda Buck and Richard Axel got the Nobel Prize for this in 2004, nevertheless, it was and still is completely clear that odor cannot be predicted from structure. Okay, so that any fragrance chemist will tell you, particularly after a couple of beers, that they have absolutely no idea, and they just make a lot of molecules. And you can have a feel. I mean, you can play around in a certain area get lucky, but you don't have a proper algorithm for predicting odor. And the fact that people don't know how to predict odor doesn't really bother the biologists very much, chiefly because they don't know any chemistry. The majority of molecular biologists know almost exactly zero physical chemistry and physics and chemistry. Okay, so but this does not inhibit them in any way. So this is what a shape-sensing receptor really is supposed to be doing. A molecule comes in, it interacts with the receptor, and the interactions, the energy involved in the interaction causes the receptor to change conformation and then triggers off a whole manner, you know, all the subsequent events which turn on the cell. So this this is the model which is not just applied to odors, but in fact comes from biochemistry in general, from neurotransmitter receptors and from enzymes in general, the interactions, you know, molecular recognition. Now, where it really comes from originally is pharmacology. So this is the beta-adrenergic receptor, which we now have a structure from X-rays. For the longest time, membrane proteins were very hard to get structures from because they don't form nice 3D crystals. They're essentially two-dimensional. So now we have structures, and here you can see all the usual, is it fusilli, I suppose, or some, I'm sure there's some form of pasta. And so in there you can see the ligand, the adrenaline in this particular case, is attached. And then when you dress it with all the side chains and all the atoms, you can see roughly the relative size of a ligand to the receptor. Now here's the problem. So this is noradrenaline in the beta-adrenergic receptor, displayed in a completely different way using a wonderful piece of software called PoseView, which flattens everything. It just basically takes the 3D picture and squashes it flat, so you can see the hydrogen bonds, all the different interactions. And you can see that this is a perfectly honest, hardworking molecular recognition problem, in a sense that the molecule of noradrenaline makes 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 hydrogen bonds with the receptor. And hydrogen bonds, as you may know, are not very strong, but they're highly directional, so that it is genuinely lock and key. In a sense, you have a molecule that has a degree of mobility of its own, but once it's bound to the receptor, you can see it in there and you can see the hydrogen bonds. So there's no question that it works that way. In fact, it works, in some cases, it works so well that you get to energies that are practically a covalent bond. In the case of biotin and avidin, you have the molecule making 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 hydrogen bonds, at which point it won't ever come off. Okay, it adds up to essentially one covalent bond. With odorants, it's completely different. First of all, we don't have a structure for the odorant receptors, as it happens. Nobody's done an X-ray yet. But the more serious problem is this. The reason why molecules actually evaporate and fly into the air and get to your nose is because they don't have strong interactions with each other or with much of anything. And therefore, they're going to be likely to make very much fewer hydrogen bonds with whatever they're attached to. In fact, if you look at the structure of odorants, not in receptors, because we don't have the receptor structure, but in other odorant binding proteins, they don't make any. This one is an unusual case where it makes one hydrogen bond. Now, this raises a very tricky question, which is, if this is so, how come we can smell functional groups? Now, let me explain what I mean by this. Are there any chemists in the audience? Okay, so.
Benzene is sweet.
Yeah, exactly. So you can smell functional groups. People, you know, a chemist will tell you that something smells sulfuraceous. It smells like an oxime. It smells like a nitrile. It smells like an isonitrile. It smells like whatever. And they can detect them by smell. If you smell a molecule that contains a CN group, a nitrile, you know it. You know it instantly. Okay? And they've been doing that since forever. And they're so used to it, they don't realize it's a miracle. Okay? Because actually, if you're only making one hydrogen bond, how do it know? What the hydrogen bond could be anything. Be OH, could be CN, could be SH, be NOH, could be NC. How can you detect all these different hydrogen? By the way, I can agree with this one. Isonitriles really are the ultimate. If you want to get rid of a neighbor or something, just they're harmless and they're absolutely pestilential. Now, let me give you an example. The classical example of a functional group detection is OH versus SH. Cis-3-hexanol is the smell of cut grass when they mow the lawn. When you put sulfur instead of oxygen, you get cis-3-hexanethiol, and it's an extremely strong sulfuraceous smell of rotten eggs, okay? The cut grass thing is still there in the background, but it's mostly rotten eggs. In fact, rotten eggs are so rare these days, and when you use the phrase rotten eggs, I'm amazed that we still use it, because when's the last time any of us saw a rotten egg? Anyway, I showed it to a physicist friend of mine, and I said, you know, it's amazing that we can tell them apart. He says, that's easy, that one's green. Okay, so, so I have it. I've actually done one for physicists. Okay, it's non-trivial to tell these dudes apart. Now, what's interesting is if you do the molecular dynamics, well, okay, there's a little bit of difference, of course, because of the size and so on. But you can imagine the molecular recognition problem is even trickier at 300K because you're being asked to tell whether an OH or an SH is there when everything's jiggling around. So it's very difficult. But for the longest time, since the 1840s, people have been saying it's not that we recognize molecules by their shape, but we recognize them by their vibrations. Okay, this is an old idea. Now, this one I put in as a matter of courtesy because he actually had no idea what he was talking about, but he does mention the word vibrations. So not of anything in particular, just vibrations. Yeah. So he's a kind of new age. Yeah. The first real theory is this man, Malcolm Dyson, who was a spectroscopist and who knew a lot about smell. And he was struck by the fact that the spectra followed the odor. And he proposed this in the late 1920s, early 30s. And it's wonderful to read the account of his lectures because there's the questions at the end. And it's very British, you know, he's doing this in London. And people are saying, you know, are saying, oh, well, good, well, let's move on. You know, there's absolutely no reaction whatsoever. And one guy says, why does diamond not have a smell? And then somebody else obligingly points out, diamond does not evaporate. And that's the end of the discussion. And then there's the most important person is a man who I think, who by his looks should be the reference scientist. if there was a kilogram, the meter, and the scientist, he would be the scientist. And he's actually Canadian, University of British Columbia, is an entomologist and chemist, Bob Wright, who really pursued this idea intensely during the 60s, and was, I think, largely ignored. And then there's Clifton Malone, who did some really wonderful work in the 80s, also almost completely ignored. Now, the biggest problem, of course, for all vibrational theories of smell is the fact that when you look up somebody's nose, you don't see this, okay? There are no spectroscopes in there. And this was pointed out many times, that doing infrared optics with living organisms was not going to be an easy one, not least because even if you could imagine, you know, produce infrared light, it would be absorbed by water within a fraction of a micron, because water is black to infrared. Now, I was always interested in this, but what made me really get into it was this. So I wanted to find some fact that was like the Rosetta Stone that would convince me there was some merit to it. So this is the vibrations of OH translated 10 to the 12 times into the audible range. And that's SH, okay? So I thought, look, if I can find something else that vibrates at the same frequency as SH, you know, we'll find out. If it smells of sulfur, that's it. I'm going to dedicate the rest of my life to this stupid idea. And so after much, much searching, which, of course, today I could do in about 5 minutes, but this was 1993, I found that the borains that are best known as rocket fuels have had the same vibration. So I called up a rocket fuel company, and I asked to speak to their chief chemist, and I said, what do they smell of? And the guy, there was a long silence, you know, where I heard shh on the line, you know, like, and he says, sir, I try never to smell them. But he wasn't very forthcoming. Anyway, we ordered some from Sigma. This one will spontaneously combust, but we ordered a stable one, decaborane. And I, to this day, I remember we opened it and it smelled of SH. And that was, to me, you know, there's just no way. You know, these two things have nothing in common, okay, chemically. I'll come back to that later. Now, of course, it turns out everybody knew this all along, not least Alfred Stock, who discovered all the boranes and who described their smell in an interminably long paper written in German as a colorless flammable gas with a repulsive odor reminiscent of hydrogen sulfide. So then when I started asking borane chemists, they said, of course they smell of hydrogen sulfide. What else is new? Now, all of this would have meant nothing much until I came across this paper, which suddenly lit up in my head, and which was in the Review of Scientific Instruments, which was basically an application of this paper written in 1966 by Bob Jaklovich and John Lamb, where they discovered electron tunneling spectroscopy. And electron tunneling spectroscopy, this is where I normally have a lot of slides for biologists. I'll skip that. You guys know what tunneling is. You know what inelastic interactions are, so I won't bother with it. But basically, it's the idea that an electron jumps from a high energy to a lower energy, and it needs, in order to do that, it needs to lose some energy along the way, and it loses it to a molecular vibration. Now, when I read this, I thought, we can do that in biology, because biology is actually full of electron currents. Inside your body is about 100 amps right now of electrons moving around. If you could borrow a few nanoamps of that to put into receptors, you could do essentially tunneling spectroscopy. So, it's essentially a nanoscale technique. So it was suited to biology. So I proposed this idea. I worked on it for like 2 years. And then it sat with Nature for 11 months. Seven referees, I think. Maybe not the record, but it must be pretty close. And in the end, they turned it down. And it was published in Chemical Senses, which is the olfactions journal. And it's the only paper ever in Chemical Senses that has original research paper written above it. Now, I have no idea to this day what that means or what it says about the rest of their stuff. So now I have a cartoon. So be ready for a cartoon.
Can I ask a question? Do you mind if
I... No, go ahead.
So, first of all, can you give us what is the energy of the... remind us, what is the energy of the hydrogen bond? Because we haven't taken...
Oh, the energy... so it's about 5 kT, 3 to 5 kT.
We have to...
3 to 5
kT.
KT.
KT is the temperature...
Yeah, 300 K, yeah.
Oh, okay. So it's... Okay. Now, next question. What about rotational excitations?
Well, in the condensed phase, you're not going to have much of that.
But this is a gas phase.
No. When the moment it enters your water or the receptor, the rotational excitations are quenched. You basically
because they're quenched by the.
Yeah, you're in a condensed phase. There's no.
Okay.
Otherwise, you have these wonderfully complex spectra. But
yeah, exactly. That's why I'm asking. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure. So all of this was pretty much, a sort of nice in theory, but. What's the evidence? And so after I spent several years actually designing molecules using this theory with a very high success rate because it was easy to calculate whether a molecule would have the same smell as another molecule by comparing their spectra. And we did very well with intellectual property. And then I got back into DARPA got interested in olfaction. DARPA has been trying to detect the smell of cabbage from Russian submarines since forever, with no success whatsoever. So, and one of their doomed projects was the one that I was involved in. But the great thing about it was that it eventually led to a collaboration with Makis Skoulakis in Athens, who is the best all-round biologist I've ever met. He knows absolutely everything. And he uses Drosophila, which is the fruit fly. I assume you're familiar with fruit flies when you have a glass of wine. I don't know, do they have them in northern latitudes? They do, right? Okay. So probably escaped from a lab, when you have a glass of wine, you end up with these tiny flies. As my father would say, they taste of wine anyway. So you swallow them. And this is an extraordinary organism because it has 14,000 genes. You can turn each one of those genes individually on, off or on using RNAis. You just order the fly strain that has that gene turned off from Vienna. You give them 25 euros, and it comes in the mail. Okay? This is amazing, right? There's no other organism for which that is even remotely possible. 7-day life cycle. 75% of genes match with human disease genes, which is actually extraordinary. I mean, flies really are diverged, a couple of hundred million years ago from where we are. But at the same time, the basic hardware is the same. So that, to give you just a random example, if you take the Alzheimer protein from humans and you put it in flies, they get Alzheimer's. Okay, so this is the sort of stuff that makes flies. They become really stupid. They have zero memory, zero ability to learn, and they die much earlier. And their brain's shot. You do the histology, it's a terrible shame. So it's just by putting one gene. So, and the most amazing thing about flies is that it's a community which does not operate on the normal rules of biology, which is, to hang on to your thing for dear life. People share the constructs. If you publish a paper that has a new breed of fly that you've made, the next day you have to supply it to everybody so they can check your results. It's really the Athenian Republic of biology, without the slaves. Well, actually, with the slaves. But now, what kind of experiments would decide whether a vibrational theory was correct? Well, initially, the obvious one was isotopes, right? You replace all hydrogens with deuterium, or as many as you can. The interatomic distances will be pretty much the same, give or take, tenth of a percent or whatever. Everything's very much the same. Vibrations are very different because twice the mass, you get square root of two difference factor. So these are the vibrational spectra. Down there is wave numbers. So hang on a second. One electron volt is 8,000 wave numbers. Okay, so all of this happens at a small fraction of an electron volt. And you can see the blue, the blue curve is the CH. So that's OH stretch, CH stretch, and then the fingerprint region, as it's called. And when you replace hydrogen with deuterium, you get a completely different spectrum. Mostly big difference here, of course, CHCD, and then other differences in the fingerprint region. So the big question was, do the isotopes smell the same or different? Now, initially, I had tried this, of course. So why do who puts deuterium in molecules for a living? The people who do NMR use deuterated solvents, so they don't interfere with the H signal. You don't have a huge range of deuterated solvents, but I've tried a few, and I thought I could detect the difference in smell between normal and deuterated acetophenone, which is a classic odorant. And most of my fragrance friends, you know, perfumers and so on, could as well, but ordinary people could not. And so there was a big problem there that we couldn't actually do the experiment properly on non-professionals. So, however, with flies, you can do the same experiment. So, and it's the simplicity of it is amazing. You take flies, you put them with a sort of an elevator, you bring them down, and there are two streams of air converging. And you ask them to choose which arm of the maze they're going to go into. So if they hate the smell, they go the other way. If they like it, they go into there. At the end, you just take out the two tubes and count the flies. I mean, that's as low-tech as anything ever gets. And you just count the flies. Now, when you expose the flies to acetophenone as a choice between acetophenone and air, I mean, non-volatile oil, they like acetophenone. So the bottom axis is percent excess flies in that arm. And the way you do it is you put lots of flies in there, you do it several times, so you have good statistics. With normal acetophenone, they go to the acetophenone. With D3 acetophenone, with three deuterium atoms, they don't like it as much, but it's not statistically significant. With D5, they start to avoid it. And with D8, they really don't like it. Okay, so it becomes highly statistically significant. So what you can derive from this is they can tell the difference between normal and deuterated acetophenone. Now, if you present this to a bunch of chemists, they'll say, there's an impurity in the acetophenone, which has nothing to do with the main compound, which is for some reason causing the flies to run away. Actually, the difference in smell is due to impurities. And there's merit to that because we can tell different batches, for example. If I give you five different batches of acetophenone from different manufacturers, actually, with acetophenone, not so much, but with lots of other chemicals, you can tell the small, minor differences in smell. Impurities really do matter, okay? So it's not a stupid rejoinder to this. It's actually very pertinent. So how do you get around this? Well, you can train them with electric shocks and satisfy your sadistic impulses. So you can train them to avoid one particular smell, and they remember for several days. Okay, after a couple of training sessions, they will stay away. Flies are remarkably clever, actually. Now, if you have H octanol and D octanol, which is what I showed you the spectra of, they have a slight preference for the normal octanol. If you give them shocks on the octanol side, if there was octanol in there and you give them a shock, they go towards the D-octanol. They then avoid octanol, okay? So they can tell the difference. Because you give them shocks to one, they go the other way. If you shock...
The difference between the impurities, right?
Wait. I'm coming to that. We're building up to the climax here. So then if you shock them against D-octanol, they go towards H-octanol. Now, impurities. Suppose they actually can smell deuterium, okay, the CD stretch. Then they should be able to transfer that from the training with octanol to another molecule, another pair of molecules, H and D, which will have completely different impurities. Okay? So this is the next experiment where we do a cross-learning. You train them with octanol, and you test them with benzaldehyde, H and D. Benzaldehyde is bitter almond smell. So when they're shocked against the normal octanol, they avoid the normal benzaldehyde, okay? And when they're shocked against the D-octanol, they avoid the D-benzaldehyde. At which point, the impurity thing becomes a little bit harder to explain because you can do this transfer between several different molecules, and each time the probability of the same impurity being there becomes lower and lower, particularly because you can do GC, gas chromatography, mass spectrometry to show that there is not the same impurities. There may be some, but they're not the same. But the ultimate experiment, which is the one that makes the chemists really sort of pay attention, is the one where if you notice there's an interesting coincidence that one of the interesting things is that the deuterium CD stretch is the same frequency as CN stretch. CN is triple bond, CD is a single bond, but they have the same 2150, roughly the same frequency. So then we can ask the question, can the flies be trained against a nitrile, a CN, and then they avoid deuterium? Okay? And of course, you can well imagine, if the answer was no, I wouldn't be standing here. So,
can I ask a question just to make sure?
Sure.
This experiment here with the this compound,
yeah.
They weren't shocked.
Yeah, they were shocked. They were shocked against a different thing here. Here they were shocked against octanol before being presented with that. Yeah, before.
In that experiment, they were not shocked.
No, in the first one, no, they weren't. No.
First one? No, that one.
No, hold on. They're first shocked against
octanol,
and then presented with a choice between benzaldehydes without shock.
Okay.
So now we have nitrile and aldehyde, this two molecules differing only in the functional group, and they have no preference. You shock against normal octanol, they don't understand the question. They literally, you know, what does that mean? It's unrelated. If you shock them against D-octanol, they avoid the nitrile, okay? Now, at that point, you have a series of data which suggests that impurities are an unlikely explanation for this thing. It looks like they're smelling vibrations. Now, flies are good. It's amazing, by the way. In the field of smell, it's very strange. People don't trust their own sense of smell. They're more convinced by the fact that flies do this or that than by smelling something themselves. Okay, it's almost as if you thought about this as color vision, you know, in color vision, you show a slide of a color illusion or something, and you don't need to ask the flies what they think. Okay, in olfaction, it's really remarkable how olfaction is perceived as a personal sort of subjective affair. Whereas if it were like that, there would be no cuisine, no cookery, and no perfumery. Anyway, so we were trying to see whether humans could actually smell isotopes. Okay, and the logic was with acetophenone, it was really tricky. I mean, it was on the edge. We calculated that if my colleague Simon Gain in London tested people for 5 years every day, he would get to statistical significance, but that didn't seem practical. So we decided to do something slightly different, which is to have a molecule with the maximum number of hydrogens that you can have in an odorant, on the grounds that maybe the signal was too weak with acetophenone, which only has 8 hydrogens. If you put more, you might be able to detect it. Unfortunately for us, there was a beautiful series of papers that appeared in the early 2000s with a novel method for replacing hydrogen with deuterium. Instead of synthesizing a molecule, you take the molecule full of hydrogens and you cook it at a fairly low temperature, 120, or even actually works at room temperature now, with a catalyst in deuterated water. And gradually, all the deuteriums get exchanged using the rhodium catalyst. They normally don't. And you end up with 95% deuteration. And we chose the molecule that has the most hydrogens that we could get our hands on, which is this cyclopentadecanone, which has 28 hydrogens. And then we did, to avoid the impurities problem, we actually used a special technique invented by Christina Zellano, who's a very brilliant grad student from the US, where we put the molecule into a gas chromatograph. Do you know what a gas chromatograph is? Anybody here doesn't know? Okay, all right, okay. Gas chromatograph is basically a very long, like 40 meter long capillary tubing of silica. And it's coated with some grease. The walls of the capillary are sticky. And you inject a molecule at one end and you push it along with a gas. And it travels and travels and travels. And out it comes at a particular time, which depends on how much it's got stuck to the walls. Okay? So if you have a mixture of molecules, it'll separate them because they will not stick the same amount to the walls. So this is a fantastic instrument to take a complicated mixture and separate it into components. So when you put a mixture of H and D cyclopentadecanone into a gas chromatograph, first comes out the H, nice peak, and then the D's come out. And the reason it's more spread out is because your deuteration method creates a mixture of the various. You don't fully deuterate. You have D26, D28. But here's the thing. You can capture that peak, the big peak, into a little Eppendorf, a little plastic tube, absolutely pure. You just put the tube on the exit of the gas chromatograph, and you capture it, and then you seal it. And then you can do A-B tests. And that's pure. There are no other impurities in there. And we tested it on. So the idea was, are they the same or are they different, was the question. And we did randomized tests. And we found that people could absolutely reliably tell deuterium from hydrogen. Now, to my mind, they were like night and day. I mean, musk smells of musk. It says to somebody in fragrance chemistry, it's a sweet animalic smell. The deuterated musk smells waxy and really harsh. So it was really, really easy. So I scored, I'm up there somewhere. In the blind test, I scored 12 out of 12, which I was pleased because I'm supposed to be the smell guy. If I'd screwed up, that would have been the end for me. And then my grad student, Cleo Maniati, KM, 17 out of 17, just to outdo me. So this pretty much, at least for musks, established that you know, on a first approximation, we can tell whether a molecule is deuterated or not. Now, this is a great picture. So that's Simon Gain, who did the gas chromatography with Ian Smith at the back, who invented that particular technique of smelling GC. And that's Cleo and the chemist who made the musk. The moment they smelled it, this is the actual, I had a camera ready. I hadn't smelled it myself. And when I saw Cleo's face, when she smelled the deuterated musk, that was the best day of my life. Now, this is a very important question, which really defines the difference between a shape and a vibration theory. If you have, imagine you have 400 receptors, as we do. And in shape theory, you're saying the shape of each receptor basically determines what it's going to bind to, and the brain looks at the pattern of the receptors and tells you that's the smell of the molecule, okay? In vibration theory, you're doing something completely different. You're basically grouping the receptors into classes, probably like color vision, spectral classes. So you're looking at, you have, out of 400 receptors, you have maybe, I don't know, 50 that look at the 1,000 wave numbers, and you have 50 that look at 1,500 wave numbers. And so what you're trying to do is to catch everything and then measure it, okay? So if you change all the locks, in a shape theory, the smell would be completely different, okay? You've changed the pattern of activation. In a vibration theory, as long as there's enough receptors binding to the thing to measure the frequencies of the molecule, the smell would be the same or similar, okay? This is very fundamental. Now, how do we change all the locks? Well, you can do it two ways. You can go in there and engineer every single receptor in a fly, there's 63 actually in a fly, engineer each one to change the binding pocket. You don't even know where the binding pocket is. So it would be a nightmare. You can't actually change all the locks in humans or in flies. But here's what you can do. You can ask the flies whether they smell the same, whether things that smell the same to us smell the same to them. And that's exactly the equivalent question, because the fly smell receptors are totally different from ours, evolutionarily. They diverged a long time ago. They have no sequence homology at all, okay? So that if, for example, boranes and sulfides smelt the same to flies as they do to us, that means it can't be shape, because the shapes would be completely different. Okay? You understand? We assume we change the shape of the locks, and we ask, do the keys still work the same way? If they do, then it's not the lock and key, it's something else in the key. So this is what we did, and we did it. So this is my favorite book. Some people read Socrates, I read a different. This is George Socrates from Brunel University. It's a great book. And in it, he points out that, so we use two examples. One is this remarkable thing where you have two molecules that differ in the placement of the hydroxyl group, 2 and 3 hydroxybutyronitrile. And this is, that one's called a cyanohydrin, but it doesn't matter. The difference between these two guys is that the CN stretch is much more intense in the 3 than the 2. And you can smell that, because you cannot smell the CN in the 2. If you smell the molecule, it has no nitrile character. So in other words, the smell of the molecule matches the spectrum. And we asked the flies whether they feel the same. And so if you look on the left, they have the 2 and the 3 butyronitriles. When you shock against an aldehyde, nothing happens. When you shock against the nitrile, they avoid the 3. They avoid the 1 that smells of nitrile to us. Okay? So this is a remarkable result. And you can do the same thing with nitrile and aldehyde, and that's a significant result. So they go towards the nitrile, but when you shock against this guy, they avoid it. When you shock against that guy, they don't. So this is one type of evidence that the flies actually consider compounds that they have the same perception of a particular pair of compounds as we do, despite having completely different receptors. And of course, the one that we couldn't resist trying is the sulfur borane, since that was the Rosetta Stone for this whole affair. So we tested, mercaptan ethanol smells bad, but not that bad. I mean, in terms of doing the experiments in a building where other people are working, if you open a normal SH compound, they evacuate the building. Okay? This one is tolerable. So we tested them, and look, this is the positions of boron and sulfur in the periodic table miles away. I mean, chemically, they have nothing to do with each other. So you have, in the top, you have decaborane and air. Now, if you shock against decaborane, they avoid the decaborane, as they well should. And if you shock against mercaptoethanol, they also avoid it. I mean, not as much, but they no longer like it. Why they should like decaborane, by the way, is a great mystery to me, but because it doesn't smell very good. And, excuse me, here you have decaborane and air, and you shock against decaborane, they avoid it, and then you shock against another molecule unrelated, benzaldehyde, and they don't avoid it. So you show that it's not just the presence of a smell which they're avoiding, it's the specific smell. So that's where the situation sits right now. We don't have, so I'm pretty convinced that both flies and humans can smell molecular vibrations. I'm also convinced that the shape theory doesn't work at all, okay? So as every scientist does, you're doing both destruction and construction. You're basically trying to disprove a theory and propose a different one. I think what we don't have yet is we haven't caught the electrons in mid-flight, so to speak. We don't have a measurement that shows that the receptors actually use electron tunneling to detect vibrations. And for all I know, they may be using another mechanism as yet as yet undiscovered. But I do think that both flies and humans essentially evolved the same system to measure not just the presence of a molecule, but its chemical constitution, which is why olfaction is our chemical sense. And that's it. Thank you very much for your attention.
Explain the cartoon again.
Which cartoon?
The cartoon that you showed. Someone asked a question and you didn't actually get
it. Okay. I'll go through the blackboard. There's a certain dignity to it. So you have in a classical inelastic tunneling spectroscopy, you have two metal surfaces very close to each other with, let's say, 1 nanometer or something in between. And you have the Fermi level of one is here, and the Fermi level of the other is here. And how you change that is simply by putting a battery. Okay? Now, all these electrons are going to jump from filled to empty level, so you get a big elastic current when you have a voltage difference. But you also get, if you have in here some dipole which has a particular vibration, a resonant frequency, and suppose that this vibrational frequency corresponds to this much energy. When you get to that energy, in addition to the elastic current, which is always there, you will get an extra bit of current, which is the inelastic current, which is electrons that have jumped from here to here. Okay? Now, the ratio of elastic to inelastic in the case of metals is enormous, because you have all these lot of states below the Fermi level. If, however, you arrange it such that you have a very narrow band, or indeed no longer a band at all, you have a hopping system where electrons are confined to rather narrow energy states, they can't be much narrower than kT, okay? In fact, they're going to be broader, maybe a factor of maybe 2 or 3 kT. But you can arrange it so that there's no elastic current. So you have a slightly different arrangement whereby you have a level here, a level there, and under normal circumstances, there's no current that flows. And when you put the molecule with the right energy, which corresponds with a vibration of the right energy, which corresponds to this, then you get current flow. So it becomes a switch. Now, the exact conditions under which this works, this is completely different, really, situation than here, because here the electrons are in a band, they have momentum, they arrive at the barrier with the momentum and everything, whereas here they're basically stuck here waiting to jump. The exact conditions under which this work are the subject of a lot of mathematical analysis, and there's some disagreement as to what numbers you need to have. For example, what does the dielectric constant have to be of the whole thing? How much rearrangement of charges there can be before and after? All this stuff is more like Marcus theory, so it's more like the theory of charge transfer in molecules. And it's all in that review that I showed you in the beginning, the Advances in Physics review. But basically, the bottom line is that the conditions under which this might work are plausible in biology. Certainly, the voltage, the overall voltage, maximum voltage, is about 0.4 EV, which is fine. We've got that sort of battery available. Does that answer your question? Okay.
Other questions from students?
Do you mind summarizing the arguments of the people who don't like your work?
So what is their argument? So the implausibility thing. So what they did was, first of all, they claimed that our MUSCs were not pure enough, even though we had used gas chromatography. Then what they did was they did experiments with tissue culture cells expressing, in other words, tissue culture cells in which human receptors had been inserted. These are not neurons, okay? And they found that the tissue culture, the response of the tissue culture cells to the isotopes was the same, okay? Now, the reaction, you know, my attitude is, once you've taken a receptor out, completely out of its normal environment, you put it in a tissue culture cell, the most miraculous thing is that it responds at all. The fact that the amplitude is the same, I don't care. Okay.
Can you explain what they measured exactly?
Okay, so they measure. So they have, you have a cell with a nucleus, and you express, you make it, you give it the RNA to make a particular type of receptor on the surface. Mm-hmm. And when the receptor is turned on, you engineer it so there are some calcium channels that open up when the receptor is turned on, and then you measure the fluorescence due to the entry of calcium. So it's rather indirect. I mean, it's not a bad method, but it's more qualitative than quantitative, really. Okay. But here's the thing. In order to do this experiment, they had to, allegedly, make a much purer preparation of the two musks in quantity. Okay? They had some good chemists on the job. And when we asked them, do the musks smell different, they refused to answer. Okay? And you can bet your bottom dollar that if they had not smelled different, that would have been in the paper. But of course, they do smell different. And so that's the state of play. It's a nice experiment. A lot of work went into it. But so what? It's a very distant relative to the real thing. But it's amazing, actually. It's amazing that people are more inclined to believe literally fluorescence, calcium fluorescence in heterologous express receptors and their own damned nose. This is the thing that blows my mind. By the way, sorry.
Yeah, no. The other question is about the issue of the shape. When they talk about shape, for example, does the angle between the bones change when you change the isotope?
No.
Okay.
No, some things do change. I mean, otherwise they wouldn't. I mean.
No, the vibrational is...
No. But even in the gas chromatography,
yeah.
The fact that the hydrogen comes out 30 seconds earlier, after 40 meters of piping, tells you that those molecules are not absolutely identical in physical chemical properties. Otherwise, they... But it's like, do we have 40 meters of pipe up here? No.
Yeah. The other thing, the energy that you mentioned for the hydrogen bomb...
Yeah.
Is comparable to vibrational energy.
Yes, absolutely.
So does it change the binding? So when you try, let's say, I'm trying to see what is the microphysics of this. Because you have your receptors, they must be somehow measuring the vibrational levels.
Yeah, so.
So do they alter what you measure? Because
no,
the energies are comparable, right?
No, wait.
Strong.
So that's very important. Thank you, it's a good, very good question. So. The important point to remember here is that if a molecule can, if you can have a hydrogen bond like OH to, let's say, O, that's an exchangeable hydrogen. That hydrogen can't, the reason there's a hydrogen bond is because it can't make up its mind as to which atom it belongs. You understand what I mean?
Yeah.
So those you cannot use for isotope experiments because the moment it hits the water in your nose, all the deuterium is gone and replaced with hydrogen, okay? When we use the hydrogens on the musk, or you deuterate the musk, all those hydrogens are non-exchangeable. Okay, they will. You can wait for a million years without the rhodium catalyst; they will not exchange. Okay, so they don't make hydrogen bonds. So basically, odorants are glued to the receptor mostly by van der Waals interactions.
Oh.
Okay, mostly.
How much density do you need for the when? So you mentioned the size of the molecule
in
the beginning. What is the density of molecules that we are most, I guess it's a bit subjective. How many molecules do we need to send?
Oh, that's a very good question. All sorts of stupid numbers have been proposed, mostly plucked out of thin air. For the longest time, people said that only like 5 molecules of vanillin were enough to give you a sensation of vanilla. Now, it turned out that number was off by like 3 orders of magnitude. I don't know is the answer. But one thing's for sure, and I think the people who wrote that paper disproving a theory did some very fine work showing that the receptors contain a metal atom, and that's why sulfur compounds are so powerful. Metal. It's a metalloprotein. Metal. An ion.
Yeah, yeah.
Like zinc or copper.
Okay.
And that's why sulfides or thiols are so powerful, because they bind like hell to the metal. Okay. So it's not so much how many molecules, is how many actually will stick.
So the important thing may not be even the hydrogen bond, maybe.
No, it's van der Waals.
It's van der Waals.
Van der Waals, mostly van der Waals, mostly dispersion forces.
And that's enough to even suppress the rotational vibrations.
Absolutely. In a condensed phase, you don't no longer. First of all, the lines are really broad, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, you know.
No, that's why. I mean, everything is done at room temperature.
Yeah. The lines are broad.
Yeah, there is a lot of
I'm not sure what kind of question this is, but if our noses are responding to the vibrations of molecules, how come smelling something isn't like hearing?
Oh.
Our ears respond to vibration and we hear pitches. How come we don't sense pitches when our nose responds to vibrations?
Okay, so I'm glad you asked that question, because I'm very interested in the perception of pitch. When I was a lecturer at UCL, they said, "What do you know about?" I said, "Smell," and they said, "Great, you'll do hearing." So I had to study this. So one of the peculiarities of hearing is that pitch is not just due to the actual vibration. Our perception of pitch and timbre is due to the spectrum of harmonics and partials. So that any object that you strike or that produces a sound is sufficiently nonlinear in its physics to give you the harmonics. And in fact, all the rules of harmony and so on are due to the overlap of harmonics. So that there's a very big difference between hearing and smell in this, in that in smell, the range that we smell is basically 1.5 octaves. Okay? Let's say from 5 kT to whatever, to 15 kT, let's say. No, to 10 kT. In hearing, it's 10 octaves. Okay, so a completely different thing. But you're saying, why don't we hear sounds when we smell things?
Why isn't the sensation of odor more like the sensation of pitches? If they're vibrations, if they're vibrational pitches.
Well, I find the odor very much like pitch, but maybe that's my problem. I mean, to me, a nitrile smells like a sharp compared to a ketone. So
I have something to say here. This was a person who tried to quantify people's olfactory perceptions, and they could say things like, I don't know, like banana was between cherry and rose or something like that. So they have done experiments where people have sort of smelled the descriptors of things. Mm-hmm. Like, well, they were trained on what the descriptors of smells, and they wrote down each thing they're smelling, and then they did some sort of like distance measurements, like with computers computationally, to figure out like the distances between their descriptions of their smells. So they could actually put smells in order, sort of like you can hear, like I think with the voice, or with, you have like when you make a high pitch sound and a low pitch sound, it's something that sort of happens in your body, and you have sort of like a high to low feeling from that. But it seems like people can also place odors in between each other and make an order to them as well. I don't know.
But I think the question is that we have so assume that all this is correct, and we have three vibrational senses, right? So we have two known ones, which is color vision and pitch, that operate on two very different principles.
That's already a question.
Right. So is it more like color vision or is it more like pitch?
That
we don't know.
The three seem to be completely different.
Right.
And how is that difference generated in the brain? I know these are questions we don't know the answer to, but this is a measure of our ignorance of the relationship.
No, absolutely.
Between what's going on in the brain and perception.
Well, okay, so the other thing with smell is there's a time dimension, because you don't smell things unless you sniff, right? Try this if you have a perfume or something. If you inhale continuously, you don't get much of a sensation of smell from anything. You have to go, okay, so there's a T0 after which things happen, okay? So that is is a bit like striking a, to me that's more like timbre. Mm.
In the Misha. Fly experiments, can you stock shift some of the vibration levels and see?
That's a classic physicist question. Can you put an electric field, you mean, on them?
On the molecules, right? So you stock shift them and see if...
You'd have to put a heck of an electric field on the fly. It has to be stock shifted. I mean, first of all, the entire fly will be stock shifted. And secondly, an enormous...
As long as they don't touch the ground, they're fine.
An enormous spark will fly. An enormous spark will probably incinerate the fly. But we haven't tried. I don't know. How big are stark shifts?
No, they can be significant. But
in terms of wave numbers? I mean, what kind of per voltage gradient?
I don't know.
They're of order the rotational energy splittings. I mean, they're pretty small. There may be ways...
Wait, I mean... For rotational energies is, I mean...
Oh, exactly, so it's very small. This is what I'm saying.
Right. So you're never going to change a stretch frequency, right? With a star shift.
Come on, you can measure the mass of the W and Z bosons with spectroscopy, right? At 14 digits in a optical frequency, right? So I'm sure...
Yeah, with giga electron volts, correct?
Yeah, but resolution, right? So spectroscopy, you can go fetch digits, right? So star shifts, you don't have to apply,
Okay, to be honest, Michel, nobody's ever asked that question before, and I don't know what the orders of magnitude are. And my worry would be that everything in the fly will be stock shift. Well, every protein, every dipole will suffer the same effect as your odor.
Right, you're not flying it.
So that
as simple as measuring a line with an atom.
No, but suppose we could stock shift just the odorant. That would be a heck of a nice experiment. Of course, that'd be wonderful.
Have you tried putting electrons in, polarize the molecules and put them in a strong magnetic field, which will not do much to the fly?
Hold on a minute. No, nuclear polarization, you're talking
about? No, I mean, have an unpaired electron spin somewhere. Are there molecules that have unpaired electrons?
Oh, yeah, there are plenty of free radicals.
Try to see if you put them in a very strong magnetic field, what will
so,
happen?
So, hold on a minute. I don't think that would make any difference to vibrational spectra. It would be, because...
It will change on the state, right? It depends if you start with a polarized, it depends on what the ground state.
No, wait. You're talking electronic excitations there.
No. I mean, it will change.
I don't think it will do much to vibrational spectra. In any event, to get to the kind of energies we're talking about, you'd need like a 200 Tesla.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah. We don't have that on hand. You're going to ask a question?
I was wondering if we knew anything about the smell that comes from combinations of things. For instance, if I'm talking about visual perception, and I combine, just have a red LED and a green LED, you get a yellow LED, yellow light that comes off it. So even though if I start off at two different frequencies, I'm sensing another third.
Yeah, no, I understand. But the problem in smell is the opposite. Every molecule has more than one, every, 3N minus 6 vibrational modes, right?
Yeah.
So, and here we get to a really weird fact. You might imagine that you could put an electrode of some kind in the up the nose, go to the olfactory epithelium, turn on the current, and elicit a smell sensation. People have tried this for 50 years now, and nobody has ever managed to elicit a smell sensation by direct stimulation of the olfactory epithelium. Now, if we could, then we would actually, and if the electrode were small enough, and if you got lucky, that would be the primaries. You might imagine that you would excite either one vibration or one shape, depending on which theory, but it doesn't work for some reason. I actually had at one point got my hands on a tuned infrared laser, and I put an optic fiber on the end of it, and I pushed it up my nose, but I locked the door so that the safety officer couldn't come in And so I pushed it. You know, I had no idea where the damn thing was, of course, but it was far in, I can tell you that. And then I pressed the button at 2550 wave numbers, and I smelled absolutely nothing. Okay, so that's as far as I went. Then I pulled the thing out quickly, acted natural, cleaned the fiber. And... But if we could stimulate directly, honestly, if somebody comes up tomorrow morning with a method of stimulating the olfactory epithelium directly, and in fact, it could be done, okay, already, because you can have optogenetics. I don't know if you guys know about this. You can insert into any chosen cell a protein which responds to light by opening an ion channel. So in principle, and I would be more than willing to be the subject for the experiment, you could put a protein in one type of receptor that responds to light, and then shine a light with a torch, literally. And then you would smell something. But nobody's done it.
What if you can turn that on?
That would be a drive. Depends what the smell is.
What about your theory with synesthesia? How does that sort of fit in?
See, my feeling about synesthesia is I look at it from the musical angle. You know, you had Scriabin, who, you know, at the piano could see colors when he played chords, you know? And then you have Messiaen, who could see colors when he played chords, and they saw different colors. So to my mind, those, you know, that's where my interest in synesthesia drops to about zero. It's interesting as a phenomenon, but I don't think it illustrates a fundamental relationship between the different kinds of synesthesia. I think it illustrates the fact that people are wired differently.
Back to the slide when you show the movie with the electron tunneling through the
movie. You guys like that movie, eh?
Can you talk about this a little bit?
Sure.
I was wondering on this molecular level, the electron tunnels from odorant molecule to the receptor molecule?
No, it tunnels.
What is this study?
So it, so.
Inter or inter.
So here's the thing. In all olfactory receptors, both flies and humans, there appears to be a tryptophan close to the binding pocket and a metal atom also close to the binding pocket. We know this from rhodopsin, which is the great granddad of all G-protein coupled receptors. So tryptophan is the best electron donor. And in order for electrons to be given up by tryptophan to something, the unoccupied molecular orbital has to be lower than the occupied one. And you can only achieve that with a metal atom. And as it happens, rhodopsin has a zinc built in to the protein that nobody understands the function of. So the amazing thing is that if you look at the great grandfather of all G-protein coupled receptors, it has the building blocks of an electron transfer. Now, in rhodopsin, the electron transfer does not happen because there's an aspartate next to the zinc which cancels out the charge. There's a negatively charged. You know. But if you remove that, it would go across the retinal. So we're not, you see, the physics of the actual protein is the part that's missing. How to do experiments, how to measure it.
So people were asking before about start shift and things like this. What about fabricating some nanomolecule with particular vibrational properties and then trying to smell that nanomolecule?
So all organic chemistry is about, I mean, you know, that's what I did for a living, making odorants, calculating odorants and making them. And we could predict pretty well from vibrational spectra.
Yeah, but I mean, something that's really fabricated. So you design it with a particular frequency, vibrational frequency.
You're still constrained by the periodic table. You know, it has to be chemically stable, volatile, relatively non-toxic. But you're still playing with what I call the upper east side of the periodic table, CHONS. You know, the moment. Okay, so let me give you a counterexample which goes along what you say. There's some very good chemists in Germany who made a series of compounds where you have carbon bound to, so let's say CH3, and then something else, okay? You can replace this carbon with silicon, germanium, and tin, right, going down the column. Do the molecules smell the same? I mean, the shapes are very similar, okay? The molecules smell completely different, okay? So if I put even just silicon in here, you get a totally different smell. So that's been done. I mean, there's a lot of data out there on this. And in fact, some of these sila odorants, as they're known, are very interesting because they give a different smell with known chemistry. So, some people are actually thinking of introducing those in perfumery. That's not super popular.
Could you explain this better again?
I thought that was the easy part. I was assuming that you guys were totally au fait with electron tunneling and quantum mechanics.
There is a part of the receptor.
Yeah.
That donates an electron to another part.
That's right. That's right.
And what is the role of the molecule?
Oh, so the idea and really, the proper physics of it is in that review that I mentioned. But the basic idea is you have a donor, you have an electron, a highest occupied molecular orbital at this level, and you have a lowest unoccupied molecular orbital below that. And so there's going to be electron transfer. The question is, what is the rate of electron transfer with and without a vibration in between? And so if you do the calculations using Marcus theory, you can by fiddling the numbers of energy levels, et cetera, ultimately what drives the thing is the partial charges on the molecule. Okay? Let me explain that. If you have a molecule composed of atoms that are of different electronegativity, even though the overall molecule is neutral, the atoms will not be exactly neutral. The electrons are always shifted one way or the other. So what happens when you have an electron charge over here is that you distort the molecule. And when the electron jumps, it relaxes back. That's the mechanism.
Thank you.
Okay, there are no further...
There's one more question.
Oh, there is.
So in one of your slides, you made mention of the Grignard tunneling. So I want to know how it's connected with the smell.
No, I didn't mention Raman at all. So,
the book that you had said Raman.
In the book, yeah, in my book, yeah. So infrared spectroscopy became a big deal when Raman discovered the Raman effect, because it was much easier to make a bright visible light source and look at the Raman spectrum than to make an infrared source and look at the infrared spectrum. You understand? So the Raman is kind of like a two-photon thing. You're looking at photon energy plus and photon energy minus, Stokes and anti-Stokes. So infrared spectroscopy became hugely popular in the late 1920s after Raman's demonstration. But there's no Raman. Polarizability only comes into this indirectly.
Great. Okay, so you're here tomorrow as well.
Yeah, if anybody wants to talk about anything except smell, that'd be great. I want to know what you guys are up to. Here I am. We biologists deal with relatively small potatoes. Okay, how does smell work? Whatever. You guys are blowing my mind every other week, so I want to know what you're doing.
There's a reception in the bistro now if you want to ask more questions.
Okay,
thanks.
Great.
Again.